Okay. A man who needs little introduction, so I'm not going to give him one. It's Eben Mogan, Suffolk Freedom Law Centre. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. There's no place else in the world I go where I get to see so many friends at once. Thanks, man. One of the pleasures of speaking here is that I get to skip all the beginning stuff, so you'll pardon me for just starting right in the middle. 10 years ago, I said that by 2012, the Microsoft we knew would no longer exist, and we're right on schedule. We are in the middle of a disruptive transformation of IT again, and we're doing well, and unfreedom isn't right this minute. Because we're still at the end of what I would consider to be stage one of the great plan. The great plan, from my point of view, had three simple parts: make freedom, put freedom in everything, turn freedom on. And we are, as I say, fundamentally at the end of stage one, which is the make freedom, put freedom in everything, period. The world of server-based computing belongs fundamentally to operating systems descended from freedom. This will become more true in the coming year as it becomes apparent that the heavyweight IT vendors to enterprise in the world are moving closer to giving up on proprietary unices. The recent announcements by Hewlett-Packard to its data center customers fundamentally now spell out a quiet, peaceful end of HPUCs at last, I hear some people thinking. And that tells us, I think, something about where the political economy of the industry as a whole would go. We are now moving into a world of something we call the cloud, which for these purposes, because we've always got to sort of pin down the cloudy meaning of the cloud, for these purposes what it means is that the unit of abstraction in the network is becoming a stack, a virtual machine for some hypervisor, consisting of a workload and all the infrastructure around it. And pretty much all of that world, too, requires parts made in freedom. Most, not all, of the relevant hypervisors come out of freedom. The workloads themselves are increasingly made of some free parts running on top of some free infrastructure. But here, as everywhere else, the process of putting freedom in everything is a process of coexistence with unfree parts and structures, which are also elements of large-scale IT. On the client side, which is now the mobile client side, which is why the Microsoft we knew doesn't exist anymore, and the new Microsoft is trying for the 18th time to figure out a way to have something to do with tablets, and trying for the fifth time to figure out how to do mobile. On the client side, mobile is what we mean, and we have reached the stage where a piece of free-like software called Android is what there is, and then there's everything else. Everything else still makes most of the profit in the global mobile industry, but that's because everything else is very largely luxury goods made in small quantities for rich people. commodity mobile in the world at the moment is part of a rather unusual historically, but increasingly fundamentally commonplace thing, commercial open source dominated by a single corporate supplier who, of course, plays by the rules of the licenses it uses, but is not manufacturing community-produced software. It is manufacturing commercially produced software at price zero using open source licensing rules and also the exclusive power of the copyright holder to shape the long-term structure of the technology. Nonetheless, in a world which consists increasingly of three strategic parts, the virtualized environments which we are calling cloud, the pipes which are infrastructure running commodity software mostly made in freedom, and the mobile world, we are succeeding pretty well at getting freedom into everything, with some admixture of unfree parts almost everywhere. The problem we face now is that the second crucial stage of our long-term plan, you've made freedom, you've put freedom in everything, now you turn freedom on, is going to be a very, very difficult lift because we deal increasingly with people who have come to love the software whether or not they like the freedom and who are in some cases fundamentally hostile to the freedom, either for short-term commercial reasons or for long-term socio-political reasons. So we get our stuff in everything, and then we must struggle not only to turn the freedom on, but also to resist having our freedom turned off by efforts at the margins or at the center to make the commoditization of software not about freedom. This, of course, is another one of those purposes for which my Stallman was right buttons are perpetually useful. That was the whole point, wasn't it, of all the jumping up and down and arm-waving about the difference between free software and open source. If you don't keep saying free software and meaning it, then sooner or later you'll face your software without your purpose. And there's no doubt that that has happened. He was right. We have to deal with it. It's not a nomenclatural issue now. It's the fundamental structural problem with which we contend. It's what our diplomacy and our politics and our military activity is about. As a free software commonwealth, we're now defending the point that the software has political purpose. We too have long-term plans. We too have plans called cloud and mobile, but our cloud is the cloud of low-priced server hardware that will be dust bunnies under every couch. And our pipes are what the Scientific American this month refers to in our work as the shadow web, that is to say, the attempt to prevent the network infrastructure itself from spying on and surveilling everybody. And our mobile is everybody's mobile. We just have to be able to run our software in it. That means we have to deal with lockdown. That means, once again, Stallman was right. So I want to talk this morning. That was the whole of the introduction, because you're a perfectly knowledgeable audience, and I don't need to say anything more in introduction of where we now are. So I want to talk this morning about three parts of the large strategic picture about what happens now at the beginning of stage two as we struggle to turn freedom on, having succeeded in a really quite wonderful but nonetheless adulterated fashion in making freedom and putting it in everything. We're in a period of coexistence, and the period of coexistence includes a period of enormous hostility. 20 years ago, about the time we were talking about Microsoft would not be here now, and it isn't, we were talking about, but the software patent system will get so bad that it won't be possible to fix, which is why you have to do something about it now, and 20 years went by, and everybody that didn't dismiss us ignored us, and now the system is impossible to fix. That is to say, no matter what we do about patent law right now, we're going to stay in the middle of a really atrocious, ugly patent war, which is only now still in its early period of acceleration, and which is going to burn on for years and cause enormous harm and can no longer be prevented. This was what we were warning about. It is now being suffered primarily by the commercial parties who used commoditized software made in freedom for less than free commercial purposes. And they are now facing enormous bite for royalties from companies which are either eager for royalties or, in the case of the two primary aggressors in the patent war, Apple and Microsoft, must prevent innovation. The fundamental root of this patent war is the need to prevent innovation. Two incumbents with extraordinary cash piles and very significant strategic difficulties now must prevent the continuing simplification of global technology towards a cloud, that is to say, a complete transferal of the way enterprise workloads work towards virtualized appliances, which is not good for Microsoft, and the growth of open source, if not exactly free, mobile computing, which is death to the Louis Vuitton of mobile phones, and which therefore has to be prevented with as much force as possible. Over the last several years, between the efforts of the aggressors and Google's effort to purchase ammunition to defend itself with, almost $30 billion has been spent around the world buying ammunition. In war zones, at war zone prices, buying ammunition leads to firing it off. And increasingly, on all sides of the war, what is happening, as I talk to the strategists on all sides of the war, either directly or through espionage, what is happening all around the war is guys are having the conclusion that comes to generals in the middle of the war, which is, let's bomb the other side back to the Stone Age. And the Curtis LeMays are getting promoted in each of the places, because there's lots and lots of ammunition around, and it's not actually deterrent in a war unless you fire it. This is causing a number of secondary effects in the patent war which must fundamentally alter our strategy too. There's really no point in saying just say no to armaments in the middle of the World War II. There's really no point in arguing for another global peace conference when most of the parties fighting the war haven't lost their enthusiasm for the war yet. The actual logic of wartime is beginning to take over, and we have to live where the actual wartime is now. We don't get a choice about that. Here are a couple of the secondary consequences, some of them good and some of them bad, for the immediate future in the way the patent war is running. In the first place, large, wealthy, well-patented companies are becoming arms merchants. I don't need to tell you their names. It doesn't really matter. You know who they are. The problem is that wartime has driven the sale price of patents through the roof, and it is now worth selling more than it is worth holding most of the armaments owned by the guys who have been building armaments and salting them away in their own safe keeping all these decades. I'm not going to name anybody, and I'm not going to name any company. I'm only going to say I was talking to a very reputable fellow in a very reputable company who made the not so reputable joke that, yes, we are merchants of death now, because everybody knows it. Now, a lot of those armaments are being purchased by people who have nothing but defense in mind right now. I can say the word Google in this connection, and everybody will understand. Yes, they're not buying to crush us. They're buying to defend themselves. The problem is that the price of armaments is extremely high, and things are going to get fired, and where they land, some of us work no matter where that is. And stuff will get sold, and what buyers will do with it, nobody can say for sure in advance. Some of the people who sell patents into this environment sell them with what they call open source exclusions when they sell the patent. At any rate, they say that's been their habit, and I believe them. But with patents at least an order of magnitude higher in sale price than they used to be, if a guy comes to you and offers you seven figures for a patent, and I have seen an expired patent transacted for a seven-figure price recently, an expired patent. Well, under U.S. patent law, you can collect royalties for 3 years on an expired patent. So an expired patent that has a deep bite on it because it's an old fundamental thing that you can collect royalties on for the next 3 years is a make weight in a negotiation, a threat to throw. When patents are being transacted, individual patents at seven-figure prices, and you're selling them, and a guy says to you, would you please take the open source exclusion off that patent before you sell it to me? Maybe at $1 million you're willing to think about it. So part of our problem is that even our allies are selling ammunition to fuel the war, which means that fundamental assumptions we are making over the course of the past decade about how to deal with the problem now have to change substantially. On the other hand, we are picking up some friends that we might not otherwise have. I went to speak recently to a company whose patent licensing philosophy is not usually much in parallel with that of the free world. And I said, we have great differences of opinion under ordinary circumstances, but let me put a predicate to you. There are two classes of people who have nothing but harm in the patent wars. One of them is my clients, who are pure collateral damage all the time, everywhere. We are non-combatants, but we are being badly hurt. And the other is people like you, who have deep, well thought out, rational, long-term patent licensing schemes. The problem for you is you can't do anything rational in the middle of the war. You can't talk quietly and peacefully about you should license our patents, Mr. Customer, which is always a hard thing to do, first to sell to him and second to ask him to pay you patent royalties. But you can't do that now because you can't have a quiet, peaceful conversation about patent licensing while hot metal is screaming by everybody's ears. And you can't have rational patent licensing because you don't know the value of any patent because it's all ammunition in a war zone now and it's sold at gold rush prices like eggs in Alaska or the Yukon in the gold rush of the early 20th century, and you have no idea what patent law will be in 10 years when this all settles down, because the patent war is going to put pressure on the law and doctrine is going to change and stable patent law you need for your stable patenting licensing business isn't going to be there, or at least you don't know it will. So this is a nightmare for you too. So even though ordinarily we have very different attitudes about patents and licensing and software, let me say that for now, my predicate is that you and we have pretty much joined interests. You and we need the war to end as soon as it can end with as little collateral damage as possible. That means, from a strategic point of view, you share with us an interest in interfering with the flow of munitions to the battlefield. You need to reduce the extent to which the war will distort the global market in physical objects. And you want the war to end as soon as it can be brought to a conclusion. Yes, they said, you're right, we don't usually agree about much, but you have identified correctly our areas of agreement now. And some practical consequences will flow from that. We can't stop the patent war. Even if we were participants, we couldn't stop it, and we're not. We're non-combatants. We can't mobilize anything like the kinds of resources it takes even to be seen in this game, which is a multi-billion dollar game now. We have not multi-billions dollars, right? We're the free world. We never have. We can affect the conduct of the patent war at the margins for the purposes I've named, to interfere with the flow of munitions to the battlefield, to reduce the freedom of parties to gain more access to resources, to mitigate, that's the best we can do, to mitigate the harm done by patent selling by our friends who are fueling the war simply because it's economically irrational not to sell bullets at these prices. But in order to do all of that, we will have to be deeply embedded in the day-to-day tactical and strategic planning and execution of the parts of the war that we can see and with whose fighters we can discuss. The Open Invention Network is a crucial part of that for us, as is every other form of communal patent defense that we can encourage patent-holding allies or customers or coexisters of ours to bring to the field for the purpose of shortening the war. Last week in the Prometheus case, the United States Supreme Court gave us some help again. Stephen Breyer apparently has 8 friends sometimes for the proposition that patents are no damn good. The end of the medical correlation patent happened on a reading of the Olds line algorithms and facts of nature cases, which were being read by the Supreme Court last week pretty much the way we'd want to read them. Whether that means that we have more gas in our tank than we thought we did at the end of Bilski or not remains to be tested. And even testing it will be no small effort for us, both in resources and in the politics necessary to get there with all our various allies. But as things look right now, and everything will change again, this is wartime, everything happens very fast, but as things look like now, I would say we're on our way back to the Supreme Court the fastest we can get there with the very weakest bad old software patenting we can bring there to try and keep the gap widening, introducing more legal uncertainty about the validity of patents on software inventions will help to stop the war. It won't do it by itself, but it'll get us a piece of there, yes. They didn't expect an interjection so quickly. I'll repeat your question. The Supreme Court said in Bilski that there were levels of abstraction in patent getting that made the patents out of patent scope under Section 101 of the Act, which requires, the Supreme Court says, more than facts of nature or algorithms. In Bilski, we saw that some forms of business method patents that basically say, I do what I used to do and the Internet, are probably not patentable, although all the Supreme Court really said was this was a bad patent, it shouldn't have been issued, the Patent Office was right to decline. What we learned last week in the Prometheus case is you can't say, here's something we know about biology, here's a bunch of clinicians using the correlation between some biology and some mode of treatment to treat or test something, that's patentable. The Supreme Court said you didn't add enough to the fact of nature that was the biology just by saying, and here are some clinicians who could use it in the following way, that's not enough. What that did, however, was done by reading the very patents about rubber curing and other forms of algorithms in manufacturing that we have been arguing in Bilski before and since represent the fundamental limits of patentability under U.S. patent. So we're going to get a chance to go back and discuss with the Supreme Court again, perhaps under conditions that we think more propitious, the question, what are the real limits of patentability when it comes to thinking things up and writing them down in software talk? How we shape that, how we frame it, how we get it there is going to require us to spend a good deal of time thinking before we start doing. I would characterize what happened in the Supreme Court last week as another reason to think about doing it sooner. Okay? Let's hold more questions on patents for the end, because I don't want to get tied down only to the patent situation. There are more things I want to talk about. What the patenting situation does, however, is to remind us that the particular problem we face in the war right now is too much disruption in the global marketplace. U.S. patent law is distorting the entire world market in devices which include freedom, because the U.S. International Trade Court is being used to prevent the importation of allegedly infringing goods. That is already causing, and other litigation around the world linked to it, litigation between Apple and Samsung, for example, is distorting the global market in objects very deeply. Businesses are finding threat against the distribution of their goods. And when it is possible that there will be injunction or threat against distribution of physical devices containing software over software problems, businesses panic. And their behavior becomes both more erratic and more aggressive. This fuels the war and increases our difficulties. We will, with our partners in the Open Invention Network and elsewhere, we will aggressively continue trying to straighten out the misuse of trade law to back patent law, because we wish to bring the disruption of the global device market to an end as rapidly and as peacefully as we can. Let us say, then, that one great problem in turning freedom on is that we will not be effective at beginning to achieve the social and educational and political full consequences of the free software revolution until after the patent war is over. And that's a long time off unless we find ways to shorten it. Much harm will be done before it's over. Harm to our people, who will at a minimum find that their project development is impeded by ongoing patent difficulties. Harm to organizations that are furthering our interests, whether deliberately or unintentionally, as their market for devices that embed our freedom everywhere begins to contract, or at any rate is interfered with by companies seeking to prevent innovation. And there will be concrete difficulty for individuals and companies caught in situations in which patent war is actually making it hard for them to earn their livings and survive. At the same time that this is happening, we are also coming to a new turn in the relationship between the businesses and licenses. For a very long time, we dealt primarily with software distributing businesses. And when they didn't follow licenses, we told them, you're not following a license, and they corrected their problems, and things were fairly straightforward. Beginning in the late 1990s, it became apparent that our software was going to be embedded in physical devices. And Richard Stallman and I and everybody else at the Free Software Foundation began trying to figure out what we were going to do when software was embedded in physical objects, because it would get much more difficult to work problems out once there were large numbers of devices in the world that were non-compliant and a business either had to defend or fold on. We thought in the beginning we might be able to handle the question by helping businesses in advance to make compliant products by reviewing architecture. We tried to get some manufacturers to engage with us on that basis. We failed, for reasons which were in fact sensible. That is to say, we deserved to fail. Primarily, the problem identified by the shrewdest businesses in the world was, we're going to have too many such products. We can't engage in external architectural review with anybody Because if we have to make our product cycle conform to forms of external architectural review for compliance, we will inevitably be hindered in our ability to bring our products to market, and that's contrary to our fundamental business interests. So we will engage in architectural review if we can self-certify. Well, we said that would work fine for you because you're a company that gets it, but it won't work fine for the people who won't get it, and therefore it won't work for us. At the same time, however, we began to understand that we were not going to be able to use for much longer the mechanism of license enforcement that we had used in the 1990s. GPL V2 said, if you violate the license, you automatically lose your right to distribute, and you get it back when we give it back to you. And that structure was necessary in the world in which we then lived and served the purpose of ensuring adequate attention to compliance by software distributors after notification. You can't use our copyrighted works again until we say you can. So let's get this worked out. The problem, once the software is embedded in devices, is that such an effort fundamentally stops the manufacturer's ability to distribute goods already manufactured. Climbs down his distribution chain and back up again and leaves him no alternative. He's cornered. In effect, you're asking him to consent to the injunction against distribution of his product, which is the one thing he'll never consent to. He'd rather fight. In order to prevent the distortion of the device market, parallel to the distortion now being introduced by international trade problems in the patent law, we realized that we were going to have to shift to a different understanding of what happens at the moment of discovery of noncompliance in GPL3. As usual, Richard was quicker to come to that conclusion than I was. By 2003, Richard said, we just can't use automatic termination anymore. We have to allow people to cure their failings. I spent more time coming to the same conclusion. That's what the lawyer is for, to think more slowly. But by early 2005, when we went to work seriously drafting the GPL3 we were going to release as a first draft, before Richard Fontana came to work for me, this is one of the very few pieces of GPL3 that he doesn't deserve more credit for than me. Before we were even ready to show anybody anything, we had come to the conclusion that we could not afford distortion of users' freedom in non-compliant situations that would result from automatic termination. And so in GPL3, we went to a different approach: cure upon notification and automatic reinstatement. That required a series of careful considerations of the interaction between GPL3 and other legal systems in the world, particularly, pardon me for mentioning any names here, Germany. And after a lot of careful thinking in the Committee A and after a lot of complicated reconsideration and some employment of lawyers around the world to help us think about this and a whole lot of other process, we came in 2007 to a position about what ought to happen on license violation, which allowed us to make a transition that would prevent us from distorting the device market as we went about the business of enforcing the license. The goal here was to provoke the development within the IT firms around the world that needed it of compliance engineering that worked for them, not in order to build software for distribution, but in order to build physical products embedding software in ways that would engineer compliance in. And by the end of last decade, we were beginning to see some serious efforts to figure out how, in companies with very broad scale and lots of different lines of products, to begin to figure out how to deal not just with license compliance in their own software activity, but also with respect to their supply chain, which is the really complex and fundamentally difficult part of the story. Because there are essentially no vertically integrated device manufacturers in the world anymore. Everybody builds with everybody else's components, and half the components have software in them, and knowing what's in everything you get, which for other purposes is what supply chain management is about, requires you to embed inside multi-billion-dollar supply chain management structures the necessary effort to understand what software you're using and how you're getting it and what's in what components and whether it complies. Now we are beginning to see some more mature engineering on that subject exiting from the particular businesses that designed it and becoming available to everybody. For this reason, it seemed to me appropriate last year to begin a pause in active litigious compliance activity so as to afford an opportunity for people to get the benefit of the engineering increasingly available. I am pleased to say that among the many forms of convergence that now appears to be going on within the free world, the Linux developers seem also to have realized that the GPL v3 form of termination is the form of termination that works best for them. I'm not sure that's a consensus among the Linux kernel developers, but I've had occasion to speak to many of them in the recent past, and my sense is that the GPL2 on the Linux kernel with the GPL v3 termination clause process attached to it is where the center of gravity of that community is consolidating. I think that's good. We certainly hoped that by now we would be in a world where GPL v3 had replaced GPL v2. We certainly hoped that for this, among other reasons. My belief is that we are going to gain very substantially in the world of compliance in the next year or 14 months. I think we're going to see the onset of significant operations-based rather than legal-based compliance activities that will be available to parties on a both non-commercial and commercial basis for outsourcing, so that people will be able to get operational compliance process and they can build it, they can buy it, or they can get it from the community in a variety of useful ways. We, for our part, I hope, are going to do everything we can not to add any more obstacles to the distribution of devices in the world. The goal is and should be, in our judgment, I think, to create no more wartime conditions than already exist. If, however, we don't get the kind of movement that I think we are already seeing, we will have to go back to applying a little more force to the system. And if we apply that force carefully, and if we apply no more of it than we need, we will induce the remaining effort to absorb the compliance engineering changes that need to be made among large device manufacturers. The beauty of this is that they will do so and recover costs. Cost is going to come out of the system for them, not increase. And if we can offer people very substantial reductions in cost, very substantial increases in flexibility, and a better disciplinary system for dealing with the one or two vendors of components who cause a very high proportion of the world's GPL compliance problems, we will be winners all the way around. In this area, the free world has the same responsibility we've always had and which we've always discharged. We're providers of win-win solutions. We are not playing a zero-sum game with anybody. We've never sought royalties at the expense of compliance, and I'm sure we're not going to do so. We've never sought to disrupt people's businesses in order to gain bargaining leverage with them, and we're not going to do so. We're trying to build communities of cooperation between parties who make and sell devices for profit and parties who make and distribute software for social, political, and intellectual benefit to the world. And in order to do that, we have to keep providing people with solutions in which everybody wins. That's our creativity, that's our strength, and I have no doubt that we're going to continue to live our strength. But there will be pressure from all sides to do it differently. And we're going to have to walk our road with real care, because this is a crucial part of turning freedom on. The last thing I need to talk about is, unfortunately, lawyer geek stuff. But it has very far-reaching consequences. The nature of U.S. tax law is changing with respect to how we build free software. It is not changing in the United States Congress. It is not even changing at the White House. It is changing inside the U.S. Internal Revenue Service, which is where tax law is actually made. The administration of the tax law gives broad opportunity to the Internal Revenue Service to determine exactly what it means and how it works. Since the chartering of the Free Software Foundation as a 501c3 charitable tax-exempt organism in 1990, we have generally assumed the availability of that form of tax-exempt charitable treatment for free software projects that take legal form. And the 501c3 exempt organization has been the primary form of legal organization in the United States available for free software manufacture. It's not practically available anymore. The Internal Revenue Service has fundamentally come to a conclusion which has not yet been articulated in a formal published fashion, but which is absolutely clear if you work with the IRS on these issues, as we have always done and do every day. The IRS has fundamentally come to the conclusion that making free software is not a charitable activity within the meaning of 501c3. We are no longer able to make new foundations of that kind. We routinely made them on behalf of you and other project leadership for years, and now we are essentially at stop. Soon, I believe, the machine will begin to run in reverse. We are facing a situation in which, for reasons that may be partly political and that are surely partly the honest intellectual opinions of bureaucrats whose job is to think about these matters, we are facing a situation that will soon call upon us to make fundamental reconstructive decisions about how we organize free software projects under U.S. law. This is not going to be a small effort. It may not be particularly disruptive if it is largely or wholly prospective. That is to say, if we do not find the operation of existing entities interfered with. I'm not, however, in a position to promise that that will be so. We can hope. We're going to require a fair amount of effort here, and it will have to be spent in a number of directions. We are engaged with the IRS at the level that we can to conduct conversation about whether their increasingly firm judgments on the subject are correct. We will engage with other parties within the system that makes tax law. We will engage with parties about the politics and social meaning of this. And to the extent that what is happening is being stimulated by political efforts by incumbent businesses to prevent themselves from suffering the horrible competition which they currently suffer from nonprofits not trying to make any money and not making any money, just trying to make good software and share it with people, a form of competition they deeply resent and would like to inhibit. If there are such political efforts underway, we will do what we can politically to counteract them. But I would not say that I have confidence that we will be able to count on the existence of every existing foundation or that we will be able to ensure that our existing methods of moving monies around within the community will continue to work as we designed and implemented them. It is entirely possible that we will find ourselves engaged in trying to ensure the continuing existence of institutions we depend upon, and we may need to create new structures in new forms, which we are actively exploring and which we will provide as we need them in new contexts, as we discover that the new contexts require new measures. All of this involves activity at what is usually the invisible layer of our work. People have, by and large, taken this for granted. They either didn't need legal entities, or they had them and they didn't bother worrying too much about them, or they left it to the lawyers to deal with it and to take care of it once it had been done. And so, in mentioning this to you, I am telling you about a piece of the ecology that only the lawyers mostly have had to worry about up till now. But as clients, you need to know. And as members of the community, you need to understand. We're going to call upon you for public-spirited activity at some point in this process, because we're going to go and explain to people why what we do is not only sort of charitable, but charitable in its nature. Charitable in a way that a university is charitable. Charitable in the way that people giving away knowledge for the improvement of society is charitable. We're going to have to explain ourselves and show our principles in this context, and the time is coming pretty soon. Here, then, are the three places where I would say that at the moment we have our biggest work to do with respect to turning freedom on. But let me close with one more point. Unfortunately, also another Stallman was right point. We said in the middle of the last decade, if you start locking stuff down, you'll be sorry. And we don't want to have anything to do with it, and so we're going to write GPL3 so that we don't. At which point, some entities around the world, Verizon is the easiest one to name, went on a GPL3 is kryptonite to us and we don't ever want to hear about it again, and started beating on every vendor of software stacks for possible mobile use that no GPL3 had to be in it. And everybody in this room who works for any business that interacted with them has heard that speechify. Now, everything is being locked down, and it's a really bad idea, and even the people who weren't with us about Section 6 of GPL3 in 2006 within our community are beginning to go around and say to people, you know, lockdown is a really crappy idea, and you shouldn't do it. It's bad for you, bad for us, bad for the world. Here, I think the good news is that we're going to gain some powerful support. In the enterprise software business right now, if you're IBM, if you're Hewlett-Packard, if you're Oracle, in the enterprise software business right now, the most important thing for you is that you are living in a cloud-to-mobile world. And your CIOs, the customers you care about most, really want to know how they're going to be able to do more and more safely with what's in the mobiles their employees carry. The soon-to-be death of RIM, will precipitate a crisis in this corner of the universe as the BlackBerry goes away from industries that are totally dependent on it and which will need to replace it with something else damn soon. As that happens, they will look to the enterprise IT suppliers, who are their consultants of first resort for all such things, to ask, how do we get better messaging, better security, better data visualization, better integration with all that BI you have on top of that immense data warehouse you sold us, right to the palm of people's hands, safely, securely, everywhere, all the time? And the answer is going to be, we need to sideload stuff onto that mobile phone. No, we can't just put it in the App Store because it's not just layer 7 stuff. We need to get in there and make kernel changes for your secure messaging, and we need to do this and we need to do that. And so fundamentally, we're going to have to get into that, excuse the expression, iPhone that the guys are carrying, that your guys are carrying in your business. You have guys who want to be able to work on an airplane from an, excuse the expression, iPad. We're going to need to get in there and do some stuff to it. And those people want that to be done by their enterprise IT supplier, not by the ghost of Mr. Jobs. So what is going to happen soon is that people who had no stake in the lockdown business in 2006, except that they sold hardware to Disney, are going to find by 2016 that they have an enormous interest in the lockdown business, not in locking down their own products, but in opening up other people's. Unless they want to go into making mobile phones, which they don't, they're going to need to be able to treat mobile phones as hackable on behalf of their customers whose employees carry them. We're going to make some progress out of that if we do it right, if we're careful, if our diplomacy is smart, if our little pieces of dynamite go into exactly the right places at exactly the right times and they are no bigger than they need to be. So I like where we are. I like where we are because I think we're on schedule in the big picture. But there's a lot of stuff I don't like about the where we are I sort of like. The patent war is pure evil to us, and we're going to have to do everything we can to suppress it. The transition in compliance arrangements will be enormously beneficial, but it isn't done yet, and there's lots that could fall through the cracks, and there's lots of people who have to be brought into line, and herding those cats isn't any easier than herding our own. The 501c3 problem is going to hurt us. It's going to slow us down. It's going to make things more difficult. It's going to interfere with our banking operations. It's going to be a very unpleasant business. But it's lawyers' work, and we'll get it done somehow. Structuring transactions is not what programmers have to do. It's what lawyers have to do. And we'll figure out a way. It's going to take creativity. It's not add water and stir. And it's going to be a multi-front war, and I don't know where the resources are going to come from to fight it yet. And we will discover that the transition from a world of client-side windows and servers that ain't virtual to the world of the future, the cloud, the pipe, and the mobile, we will discover that in the process of living there, we will gain some friends for some stuff that's really important to us about which we've had little sympathy in the past 5 years. All of which put together says, make freedom, been there, done that, still doing it. Embed freedom in everything, capitalism is running ahead of schedule, particularly because the communist Chinese are such capitalists. I got called a communist in China at a business dinner recently. It was a wonderful experience. But nonetheless, turn freedom on is both absolutely urgent and more difficult than it was 2 years ago. We've become accustomed to challenges. I'm not terribly worried. We'll do fine. But we're going to be busy. Thank you very much. I'm not sure that I think that the primary difficulty will be solved by using a different monetary system. Remember that the guy on the other side of this is the tax authority. Bitcoin doesn't have any idea about how to deal with him, and we haven't earned any ease on that subject by using somebody else's currency than dollars. We're taxable when value is transferred, right? So I think payment system's not the primary part of the story, Tom. Nor is it the case that preserving the tax deductibility of contributions is the biggest of issues, because most of the money that comes into our world is given by people who might give it even if there were no tax deduction for it. I think our primary difficulty is that we have become dependent on series of operations and organizations, which we may have to modify. And if we have to retrofit existing material, there will be substantial inconveniences. There are already problems because we must find alternate ways to get people into legally satisfactory shape when we cannot count on making 501c3s in finite time, which is our current situation. I think this has more to do with seeing how we organize the things we need to organize than it has to do with paying for what we need to pay for. But let us see what happens.
Okay, a quick comment. I've become a big fan of cooperative thinking. Let me hear from there. A constitutional question. You mentioned that there's these excessive and challenging what is happening. But what about the other side? Where's the constitutional limits of the application acts? I mean, given that the constitutional authority is to promote innovation,
The United States Supreme Court said, apropos the copyright system in Eldred against Ashcroft, that Congress had the plenary power to decide what the words about for the encouraging the diffusion of knowledge and useful arts meant. And the Supreme Court thought in Eldred, when it said that about copyright, that it was even more evident about patent law, which is where they got their examples from. I don't think there is, given the way the Supreme Court sees the matter, I don't think there is any constitutional limitation set by that language. The Court has treated that language as not words of limitation. It has done so fairly consistently and fairly recently. Our argument is not going to be that there's stuff you can't constitutionally patent that you thought you could. Our argument is going to be, you, Mr. Supreme Court, you've said all the way along that you couldn't patent facts of nature, mathematics, algorithms, mental processes, and therefore there's a whole lot of stuff you have patented that's out of scope, and it shouldn't be there. And there are many complicated reasons why that's not as simple to do as it sounds like. Reasons having to do with civil procedure and reasons having to do with what our allies want and do not want.
A lot of us here in terms of the conference are individual software developers, and a lot of us work for companies that the panel would be considered friends of open source. But I'm concerned that people who value software freedom who work for these companies are going to be under increasing pressure on this kind of software price. Software patent price inflation to write patents. And I'm wondering if you offer any advice to the person who's never considered signing a software patent and never thought that they would be asked to offer one when the message comes from the boardroom all the way down to their boss that we better increase our software patent portfolio.
Well, I think that's a really important question. I wish it had a simple answer. It does not. I don't advise clients to throw up their jobs. I don't advise clients to do things that will get them fired because my interest in my clients' welfare is predominant. As an observer of the system, I can say that it's a drag to have a job in a munitions plant in wartime. And some people may feel that they can't, as a matter of individual morality, do that, and that they have to support their families another way. I would understand and sympathize with that point of view very deeply. I'm not put to that personal challenge in my own life, and so I don't get to say in a condescending tone of voice how I would handle it. This I will say, it isn't the case that you are yourself generating harm by generating that patent out. I don't think manufacture of one more bullet makes the slightest difference. And I don't think that you should be responsible for worrying about whether the patent office is going to issue a patent it shouldn't issue anyway, just because you helped your employer file an application that shouldn't get granted. I don't want anybody in this room who's a client of mine, who's somebody I want to take care of, I don't want anybody putting himself in harm's way because he doesn't want to build munitions. It's not my job to tell you should put your family in harm's way because you don't want to do that. That's a private decision of conscience. I will say that I don't believe you're making the problem globally worse. I don't think you're making it harder for us to achieve the right outcome at the other end. I don't think everybody should quit on that spot, but see Mr. Stallman, who would surely say you should. And as usual, Mr. Stallman may be right. No, the service has yet to suggest that, and I don't believe it ever will. I don't think there is any reason for the service to claim that there is any taxable activity occurring there. If you trade software for money, you're earning income, and that's taxable because it's income, okay? That's all. What we are talking about now is whether the IRS will accord a privileged condition, the condition of charitable tax exemption, to organizations whose purpose is as stated in their application for charitable exempt treatment that they make free software. That's a completely different setting than the one you're discussing. That's it?
That's it. We're out of time, I'm afraid.
Thank you all very much.